The Dream Team tapes Season 2. Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team is a production of Divergent Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio.
By now you know our intro, Jerry Colangelo, with sound bites from Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, and Carmelo Anthony. But this time we're going to change it up. Here is USA Basketball boss Jerry Colangelo announcing the full roster for the 2008 Olympic team.
The 12 players selected for the honor of representing the United States in the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games are Carmelo Anthony of the Denver Nuggets, Carlos Boozer of the Utah Jazz, Chris Bosh of the Toronto Raptors, Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers, Dwight Howard, Orlando Magic, LeBron James, Cleveland Cavaliers, Jason Kidd, Dallas Mavericks, Chris Paul, New Orleans Hornets, Tayshaun Prince, Detroit Pistons, Michael Redd, Milwaukee Bucks, Dwayne Wade, Miami Heat, and Deron Williams, Utah Jazz.
And I'm J.A. Adande, joined by Jack McCallum, and this is Episode 9 of Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. We're calling it Cruisin' and Snoozin'. Team USA cruises through pool play at the Olympic Games, and one assistant coach has trouble staying awake. But Jack, let's start with a quick look at the top of the roster that Colangelo just gave it. And it had 10 members of the 2008 All-Star teams there. So this elite crop of players from the NBA. Of course, you had Kobe, who was the reigning MVP. He just won his first and only MVP award earlier that spring. And then he would go on to win the next two NBA Finals MVPs. LeBron James, who would win the next two MVP awards, the most valuable player in 2009 and 2010. Chris Paul, who was the MVP runner-up in 2008. He led the NBA in win shares in 2008 for the analytics crowd. He also led the league in assists and steals in 2009. Dwayne Wade, the 2006 NBA Finals MVP, the NBA's leading scorer the season after the Olympics in 2008-09, and Dwight Howard. We forget about the impact of Dwight Howard and how coveted he was at that time. He was in the top five in MVP voting every year from 2008 to 2011, culminating as the runner-up for the MVP in 2011. That award went to Derrick Rose. And after these Olympics, he wins the next three Defensive Player of the Year awards. So, Jack, that's a sense for the star power at the top of this roster. And, I mean, if you look at it, this is the elite of the NBA at that time.
A couple things strike me there, Jay. And the first thing is, since we make so many references to the Dream Team, if you took the top three players on a Dream Team were Jordan, Bird, Magic, but not at that time. You know, Bird retired the season after, and Magic was close to the end of his career. So I would say the top three players on that team at the time they were playing, you could disagree or agree, was Michael, Scottie Pippen, and Charles Barkley. We're going to get into later whether the Redeem Team, of course, a hopeless hypothetical, could the Redeem Team beat the Dream Team, but could Superman beat up Batman? But, you know, we love hypotheticals. Kobe, LeBron, and D. Wade at the top of this roster, that might be better. We don't have time to deconstruct that because you do have the Jordan factor perhaps overweighing everything. But that's the first thing that strikes me. The second, Jay, and I didn't remember this till you, God bless you, did the research. Chris Paul, MVP runner-up in 2008. And there's only been one MVP, 6-foot MVP in the history of the league, and that was, of course, Allen Iverson. To win runner-up of the MVP in that time, and to think of what a defensive presence Chris Paul might be the best small defender in the history of the league. And we're going to see he was very important to this team, but that really stuck out to me.
Yeah, and later he would go on to defend Kevin Durant in playoff games. I remember one time there was a Clipper-Oklahoma City Thunder series, and they switched Chris Paul on to Durant, and he defended him effectively, and they come back in the fourth quarter and win that game. Also, amazingly successful at winning jump balls, regardless of who he was up against. He would win jump balls. And I was thinking about this last night, Jack, before we recorded this, about how Chris Paul, no, he hasn't won a championship, but the number of playoff games he won has to count for something. And we look at the impact he's had as we're taping this in the last couple seasons with Oklahoma City going there and then coming to Phoenix and turning these teams that were not really playoff contenders into playoff contenders and winning more playoff games. And that has to count for something. He doesn't have all the hardware that some of the other guys on this team had or would go on to have. But this guy did a lot of winning and put up a lot of impressive statistics.
Yeah, LeBron, you know, we're recording this as LeBron's in the middle of an injury, and you don't know what's going to happen out in that Western Conference, but you're right. I mean, Chris Paul, he is really an elevator, and I will always have a soft spot for him. Jay, I was working on this story about 12, 13 years ago. I had this idea to do a story on last-second shots, how they're set up, who, what the strategy is, does the same guy always take them? And I can't remember why I picked going to New Orleans. And I'll be damned if Chris doesn't hit a last-second shot. I mean, that never works out when you have this thesis kind of...
There's your lead, right? You had your lead.
Oh, man. I walked into the locker room. I'll never forget this. Chris Paul, like, has this big smile. I knew, because I had talked to him before the game about it, and it was pretty extraordinary. I want to ask you one other thing, though, about Dwight Howard and what you just said about him. This is on me a little bit, I guess. I've never seen a great player with great numbers who's been as kind of roundly trashed as Dwight. And I've sort of, and by the way, he's still playing. And now he's, you know, still contributing with the 76ers.
And he stayed on long enough, I think, to become likable. Like, think about how acrimonious the split was when he left the Lakers. And they loved him in the 2020 season. Laker fans loved him when he came back and helped them win a championship. You know, he's a guy that's better suited, apparently, as the supporting cast. He wasn't quite cut out to be the guy.
But even though he had monster numbers, you know, he was I think he was 22 and 14 guy the season of the Redeem team. But as we're going to see in these games, we're going to talk about him a little bit. He doesn't assume like a back to the basket, throw it into him position, because he never had sort of a signature move and he couldn't really face up and you couldn't put him at the free throw line. So maybe all those reasons, I'm sort of doing a mea culpa now. I really was not kind to Dwight Howard, but I'm looking at these numbers you've dug up and I guess I should have been a nicer guy to him.
Well, for some reason, we didn't let him do, by we, I mean the media and the fans and social media, we just didn't let him be himself. And he was an outsized personality, and he did like to have fun. And he's the type of guy that would go over, and as he's on his way to checking into the game, maybe there's a fan sitting courtside with a tub of popcorn, and he would reach in and grab some popcorn. And we'd all say, what are you doing? You can't be grabbing popcorn. You've got a game to play. But if LeBron did something like that, we'd say, oh, look at LeBron interacting with the fans.
right, yeah.
Right? And so his goofiness, his playfulness, and we ask that of our athletes a lot. We want them to be characters. We don't want them to be robots. And here he was, not only a player with a personality, a big man with a personality, with a playful personality, which the lack of that playful personality had gotten everyone from Wilt Chamberlain to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on the wrong side of the ledger with the fans and media, right? And he did so many things that we asked of everyone else, but when Dwight Howard did it, for some reason, everybody turned on him and hated him for it, in part because, Jack, he didn't have the results first. And remember, LeBron was hated for a year, and then he goes to Miami, and, well, he was hated when he went to Miami, and then he wins a championship. And the playful aspect of him comes back, and everyone loved him again. Remember the time a fan hits a half-court shot and LeBron comes running out of the heat huddle and he tackles him at half-court? And if he had done that a year earlier, everyone probably would have said, why wasn't he in the huddle listening to Coach Spoelstra draw up the play? And instead, he does this, and it's like, oh, look at LeBron. He's having fun. Isn't this great? And Dwight is really a lesson in how we allow some people to do things that we don't allow others to do.
That's true. I will accept that, but I'll still never love him. But go ahead. Move on.
Let's talk about LeBron. Speaking of LeBron, to watch LeBron at this stage in his career, Jack, if you remember, it was just breathtaking. And I'm sure you had the opportunity, as I did. I was fortunate enough to be able to watch him from either courtside or near the court. And taking advantage of our press passes, we got the chance to see up close a man that big move that fast. And when I used to try to urge people to see LeBron, if at all possible, at whatever cost, to see him in person, to try to, if you could, obtain a good seat to see him in person, because that was a phenomenon unlike anything else I've seen in my 2+ decades covering the league. I'm wondering if you can compare it to anything in your, 3-4 decades of covering the NBA?
Oh, maybe 5, but we'll leave it at 4. No, there's nothing like LeBron. You know, we will never get, fully be able to get that thing. Is he the best? He will never be listed as a point guard. I mean, that is never going to happen, even though he had the damn ball in his hands during playoffs as much as, like, you know, the line there is Magic and Oscar Robertson. They are the two big point guards. If you just took someone conducting the offense, facing the basket, still has his dribble, come on. I love Magic, but LeBron's the guy. I mean,
he was Magic's vision, Magic's passing ability. And let's talk about the pinpoint preciseness. Another thing I got to see up close one time during practice, it was an open practice session they had during the NBA Finals in 2016 at the Warriors practice facility. And I was able to stand behind, like, Channing Frye's in the corner, and LeBron's throwing these passes out to him as they're going through their scrimmage or their walkthrough. And to be able to be right behind the player and to see the player's perspective as LeBron would throw to him. And he doesn't do this quite as well now as he did in his prime, but he would deliver the pass precisely in the right place to make it easiest for his teammates to catch and shoot. I mean, it was just right on target. The shooting pocket is what the players call it. And LeBron would zip that ball right into the player's shooting pocket. If you go back and watch him at his peak, notice when his teammates catch the ball, they don't have to maneuver it anywhere. It's right where it needs to be. The other thing, watching him here in these 2008 games, seeing him in that Team USA jersey, the cut of the jersey reminds me of his first stint in Cleveland. You can kind of identify LeBron, the different stages of his career, also by the looseness or tightness of his jerseys. And this is still first Cleveland LeBron wearing his jersey the same way he did in that same type of jersey. Remember, it's a different jersey in his first stint in Cleveland than they had in his second stint in Cleveland. And the shorts were huge. Back then, they would drop below the knee. I can't get over how big they were. But it's not just the look. It's the way he plays. He was always facing the basket. He was always driving. This is the Cleveland LeBron, right? He wasn't shooting outside very much. They were giving him the outside shot in the NBA games and plenty of times during the Olympics. They just said, here's that shot. And back then, Chris Bosh, who was still a back-to-the-basket player, LeBron evolved that back-to-the-basket style that you see now, where he'll back guys and he'll shoot that fadeaway or dream shake, moves like that. But back then, Chris Bosh was playing with his back to the basket, and he was envious that LeBron always got to play facing the basket.
And I was always been jealous of LeBron during his career because, you know, everybody's like, man, oh, wow, this is so incredible. He does this. Of course he does it. He's been looking at offenses with the ball in his hands, facing the whole court, the whole half court for his entire lifetime of his career. Because he started out as a point guard. As a big, I'm like, damn, dude, I don't even know what's behind me. You know what I mean? If I go up to the elbow, it's really over, and I don't get to see it from that angle, you know? So him being able to see the offensive flow of the game all the time, see when somebody's face is like, okay, let's get Bosh a shot, man. Let's get CB a shot. I see the look on his face. Let's get it to him. He's always been a facilitator and a distributor. And with that said, he can always create his own shot, you know? So asking him to sacrifice to move the ball for the sake of moving the ball, I mean, he's always going to be for it.
But I would argue that LeBron earned that right by being such a good playmaker. And Jack, I'm wondering, where does LeBron fit in among the bigger players who have essentially been point guards? So LeBron is listed as a small forward, but he runs the point. And when you compare him to others of his height range, how does LeBron fit in the lineage, and who else can we really compare him to?
I was struck, by the way, I remember when we were doing that interview with Chris Bosh, and you do not hear other players use the word jealous. You know, it really struck me when Chris Bosh, and it's a factor both of, you know, the magnificence of LeBron, but also Bosh, you know, thinking like that. You know, he thought a little differently. I can remember during the playoffs, this is probably why I'm doing a podcast instead of coaching an NBA team, but I used to scream, take LeBron off of the ball once in a while. I mean, what do you want the guy to do? He's going to have to get the key rebound. He's going to have to score. He's going to have to find the right guy if he does give it up. He's going to have to get the key rebound. He was one of the best late game rebounders I've ever seen. If you look at his games, the rebounds he gets like in the final 4 or 5 minutes are amazing. And he's going to have to lock down somebody on defense. And I always thought he was more effective. Let somebody else bring it up and get it to him, maybe at the elbow. So when you factor everything in, the responsibilities that he had, and he's also going to run that offense. As I said, he's never going to be listed as a point guard the way that Magic point guard, PG, that's what he is. That is not LeBron. I guess he goes down as a small forward, but there's nobody like him, Jay, particularly as you mentioned, since he got a three-point shot and a step back. Nobody like him. Michael, one year they kind of put Michael on the ball. You know, that Michael was...
And he starts averaging triple-doubles
But it wasn't exactly the same. I think LeBron stands apart in that class as a guy running the offense, facing the basket, who can shoot outside, who can take it to the basket like nobody. You know, I don't even know who to compare him to, I guess Michael, and then find a guy also. There's nobody like LeBron.
The interesting thing, Jack, is this team comes smack in the middle of a golden era of really traditional sized point guards. Maybe they didn't all play the position traditionally, but you had Chris Paul and Deron Williams, who were both on this team, and we had a great debate going on of who's the best point guard, and Chris and Deron were certainly in the midst of that. Jason Kidd, who was on this team, not really in the debate as much at this point. He probably held the title earlier in the decade. Then you had Steve Nash, who's Canadian, so he wasn't eligible to play on Team USA. Rajon Rondo was the reigning champion, the point guard on the Boston Celtics that year. And then Russell Westbrook had just been drafted by the still Seattle Supersonics as they were on their way to Oklahoma City. Derrick Rose gets drafted in 2009 by the Bulls with the number one pick. So this field, this pack for the title of best point guard in the NBA gets even more crowded. And it's amazing to think that here's Deron Williams on this team, the 12 best players or the best team that we could assemble out of the United States. And at that point, he had yet to make an all-star team. And it was a function of just how many great players there were at that position. So he qualifies for this team, and yet he hadn't made an all-star team yet.
Yeah, and they got through this selection process, Jay, without a lot of controversy. I mean, when I look back and I did some research, I talked to some people today kind of on background, and I said, well, who was pissed off that they didn't make it? Because in 07, 06, 07, we've talked about this before, you had some other guys floating around. You had, Agent 00, you had Gilbert Arenas, the two I was most surprised about was Chauncey Billups and Paul Pierce. But Paul had kind of taken himself out because of injuries, maybe wasn't at the peak of his career, and had been on that world championship team in 2002 that finished in, you know, a millionth place in Indianapolis. But And Lamar Odom was a great national team player. But even they were not pissed off when the guards were J. Kidd, Chris Paul, and Darren Williams, because Chauncey played later. Chauncey played in 2010 for the USA basketball. So one of the great underrated things about this team was able to assemble these guys. And like you said, you know, Darren Williams could have been considered a little bit of a surprise, but hey, he absolutely belonged. And at that point, you could get an argument as to whether, hey, who do you want, him or Chris Paul?
Right. Well, there are arguments on about who should be on the team, and it was just a fun argument, a great debate to have. Trust me, we got a lot of mileage on it on those ESPN debate shows on who was the best point guard in the NBA. And it reminded me, I miss this, Jack. We don't have these musical debates anymore, like who's the better singer, Whitney Houston or Mariah Carey, or who's the best drummer. You know, best singer all time, of course, there's no debate. It's Aretha Franklin. It's amazing that it's such a subjective field. Music is so much more subjective than sports, but you're not going to get an argument that Aretha Franklin is the greatest pop singer of all time. But you could have the contemporaries, Whitney versus Mariah, best guitarist, right? We just don't have those arguments anymore. And that best point guard debate reminded me of that.
Whitney and Mariah, my daughter-in-law is going to kill me because she plays Mariah Carey, the Christmas Mariah Carey song, from December 1st until January 1st. But I'm just not seeing that. Whitney Houston seems to me in a class above.
Well, my thing is, Mariah had the better voice. Whitney was a better singer.
I'd be willing to spend another hour on this if you want to, but
it might be a separate podcast. But back to basketball.
Basketball, yeah, and that's it.
People would generally rank Chris Paul ahead of Darren Williams, but Darren would always kill him head to head. The numbers wouldn't even be close when they were matched up against each other. And we asked Darren about that. He was gentle about that, but we did ask him about that internal competition on this team between him and Chris Paul.
I feel like it was a friendly rivalry, you know, because I had known CP since college. You know, we went to Nike camp and Jordan camp as counselors, as college counselors, and met each other there. We played against each other his sophomore year, my junior year, one of the first games of the season. And so
who won?
We did. And we kept in touch, and then, you know, throughout, you know, first couple years in the NBA, we stayed friends. And when he came in town, we would go eat. And when I came in town, we'd go eat, hang out. And so, but when that, you know, we stepped on the court, it was always competitive. You know, I always wanted to beat him, and he always wanted to beat me. And so it was just kind of a friendly rivalry from that moment on.
You're listening to Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. Jay and I will be back in a minute. You know, probably it was a smart move by Coach K that he took that right out of the discussion. Will it be Chris or will it be Darren? By starting J. Kidd. And it was really a brilliant move. And I think, Jay, quite possibly my favorite stat of the entire Olympic experience. They played 8 games in Beijing, the Redeem Team did. Jason Kidd started every game. Now, we all know I think he only averaged 12, 13 minutes. He took 7 shots.
The whole time?
He took 7 shots in 8 games, and he made 6 of them.
Wow.
And there's a moment in one of the games, you know, it was another blowout. He's dribbling down court to get it started at his usual pretty good pace. You know, Jason played. He got him gone. Not that LeBron and Kobe needed to be revved up, but Jason got them going in their tempo. He is dribbling up the court. It happens to be a slow moment. They are backed off from him. They are like 20 feet away from him. And you can see Jason just stop and dribble and go, oh, shit, I got to shoot this. And he drains it. And, boy, you talk about somebody knowing their role. That really That really knocked me out. 7 shots over 8 games for a starter.
And the amazing thing is he developed into a more than decent 3-point shooter. In fact, he's in the top 10 all time in 3-point shots made, which is One of the more remarkable adjustments, I would put that up there with Karl Malone becoming a great free throw shooter after he was abysmal at the line when he first got into the league. But Jason Kidd developed, and it really starts, I'd say, if you look at the split, after this this time period in 2008 with this team. But sensing where the league was going, he needed to become a better three-point shooter. And so he winds up, by the time he retired, he was a top 10 in the history of the league and made three-pointers.
Kidd was just such a smart player. I mean, we've used this on and on about this team. LeBron's basketball IQ, Chris Paul. Jason Kidd is right up there. And you talk about somebody who knew exactly. And remember when we first started talking about him, he was surprised when Jerry Colangelo, the Godfather, asked him to be on this team. And you talk about somebody that from moment one knew his role. It was Jason Kidd.
My job was to, you know, pick up, you know, set the tone, set the table for us defensively by picking up and getting guys to come up with me. And understand that that was going to be one of our strengths is that, you know, steal the ball, create turnovers, play in the open court and have fun doing it. And then I would go sit on the bench and let the younger legs take over. And my job, again, was to, you know, on the bench, you know, make sure that we cheered for one another, because it's easy when it's 40 to 80 to just sit there and start looking in the stands. But I thought the guys did a great job for cheering for one another. And I was, again, responsible to make sure that guys were doing that.
Meanwhile, the opposite of Jason Kidd's role was Dwayne Wade. Instead of starting and facilitating for Kobe and LeBron, Wade plays on the second unit, where he had the freedom and even the mission to be the focal point with those two stars out. And you could argue that the second unit was what really set apart Team USA in most of these games, because many of these countries had multiple NBA players in their starting lineup. The Redeem team had multiple NBA All-Stars coming off the bench. And that came up when Carlos Delfino, who was on the Argentina team, had a conversation with Chris Bosh that Bosh told us about.
Carlos Delfino was a good friend of mine and a teammate in Toronto. And he was telling me, he's like, yeah, man, it's cool. You know, we already know it's going to be a tough game. But then you guys sub five guys out and a whole other five comes in. And it's Dwayne, oh, you, damn, Chris Paul, Darren Williams, damn, dude. You know, and we were picking up full court. We were pressing. We were playing fast. You know, yeah, it spoils you, man. I mean, you see how talented guys were. And I always tell people that was some of the best basketball I had ever seen Dwayne Wade play. Like, he was incredible. Like, I mean, instant, right away. He's not going to miss too many. He's everywhere on the court. He was incredible that year. And I remember just, you know, just being happy of having that luxury just to kind of play off guys, you know, and just to see how talented guys are, what their work ethic is and all these things. And just to be able to take part in that and have a good summer with it.
And Wade actually led the team in scoring in 2008. Then it was LeBron, then Kobe, and fourth is Carmelo Anthony. And the more Carmelo played in the Olympics over the years, the more the Olympics seemed to bring out the best version of him. There was Hoodie Carmelo, Hoodie Melo, and also Olympic Melo. And when we talked to Melo, the first thing I asked him about was that phenomenon of Olympic Melo.
Just playing with great players, right? And playing, you know, being in a great situation and really just being able to just kind of focus on one thing, right? I mean, everybody brought something different to the Olympic team. And, you know, and at that point in time, my role was that, you know, that stretch four who can shoot, who can stretch the floor. I mean, when you're playing with guys, you know, the Kobe's, LeBron, the CPs, and, you know, those guys, it's like, just get in where you fit in, right? Just get open. Somebody's going to find you.
And, of course, Carmelo Anthony and Jim Boeheim, an assistant coach on this team, are forever linked because Carmelo led Syracuse to their first national championship under Boeheim in 2003. Jim's son, Betty Boeheim, who had the Cues on a pretty nice tournament run himself in 2021, he was born in 1999. And, Jack, I'm wondering, if he were born 4 years later, would he be named Carmelo?
That's quite possible. You know, they do practice at the Carmelo Anthony Center, which I believe Melo parted with $3 million for that. But when you think of somebody, a one-year guy, or maybe not even a one-year guy, but somebody associated, a player associated with an NCAA championship, you know, like one guy, boy, you'd be harder pressed to find somebody more than Carmelo Anthony and Syracuse on that NCAA championship team. I mean, they had other good players, but he really carried that team. And Jim never forgot it and never will. Over the years, you know, I've been pretty close to Jim. We've had a lot of conversations. I wasn't always kind to Carmelo in some of my assessments. Do not do that in front of Jim Boeheim. Off the record, under sodium pentothal, whatever. Jim is not saying anything negative about Carmelo Anthony. And you know what? I understand that. I mean, that guy gave you a championship at a time when you weren't supposed to win it. And here is Jim talking about his one of his favorite guys ever.
First of all, he's good in international ball. It's a little different. And he's a good international player because of the way he plays and how he can score, make the three, the pull-up, post-up, whatever. But the thing that's interesting, I had to fight to get Melo on this team. That's the one thing I did. They, you know, he was not well-regarded at that point in time. There was a lot of talk, and I really talked to Jerry and Mike a long time about Carmelo because I knew he is a perfect Olympic-type player, offensive player. And he showed what's interesting, and I always hated the NBA people who wrote about him. He can play with a team. When he was with Denver and the New York Knicks, he had to take all the shots. They had nobody else. He had to do everything.
There was something about Carmelo in this. On the one hand, it's hard to explain. You're right. I mean, he was probably, you know, certainly not a top three. You could argue that he wasn't even the fourth best player. But there was something about Carmelo in that lineup of a national team guy that got them started on the wing.
Well, Jack, I will say this. I mean, he was a guy, you know, Kobe, LeBron, Wade, we'd seen they were the best players on championship teams, right? They could have that ability. If they hadn't done it yet, they would go on to do it. Carmelo could be the best player on a playoff team, which is not nothing, right? And he had demonstrated that early in Denver, and he got even the Knicks into the playoffs 1 year. So you could have Carmelo, especially at that time, be your main guy, and you were going to be a playoff team.
No question about it. And the other thing, you know, I was watching the next episode, which we're going to set up. We're going to talk about the gold medal game. And there's something else. There's 4 or 5 minutes to go, and a lot of times Carmelo was not on the floor because, as you mentioned, that second unit could really D it up, could really mix things up. You know, he wanted Chris Bosh in there. And there's Carmelo. I'm not saying somebody should get extra credit for being a great teammate, but that's when it came across to me watching Carmelo in those final minutes of the game. And he was just such an integral part of Team USA. When you're going to name the greatest players, greatest Team USA players, boy, Carmelo Anthony is right near the top.
And again, he had to do it in this case with, it's not an easy adjustment to go from taking 20 shots a game to maybe now you're only getting up half that. And his efficiency, particularly the next Olympic team, that's when he was at his best, was actually in 2012 with maybe a better team because you've got Kevin Durant there in addition to all these other main guys. And Carmelo's shooting percentages just go off the chart in 2012, but he's effective and pretty efficient here in 2008 as well. And obviously it was a key component of this championship group. Jack, what are some of the other things that stand out watching these games? One thing for me, I was a little surprised how much they went into the paint to Dwight Howard. They treated him like a traditional post-up center and they throw the ball into him. A little surprising to me, but as we go back and remember, he was the best center in the NBA at that point. What else, as you watched and rewatched these games from 2008, stood out to you?
Well, the number one thing that I wrote down is what you said about LeBron, that just electric athleticism. I think another thing was we had talked earlier about how comfortable Kobe was, Laker Kobe, L.A. Laker Kobe, on the wing. And, you know, he just seems like a wing guy. And how many times they found Kobe on the wing. And the other thing that struck me as team-wise about him, they could be prone to go to sleep, Jay. They were not, you know, the teams that they played up until Spain were, you know, they didn't get the best competition, but they would let some teams back in. And there was one point, it was against Angola, for God's sake. You know, Krzyzewski, you could look at him once in a while on the bench, and he would be boiling at him. And as we're going to see in the Spain game, he throws out a couple F-bombs. But in the third period, they're kind of, you know, as to use a quote from Bull Durham, they're kind of lollygagging their way through the game against Angola. Krzyzewski puts them in a half-court trap. And Wade, LeBron, Darren, and Chris Paul, I mean, if they would have played that half-court trap for like 8 minutes, I don't think Angola would have got the ball above midcourt. And one other thing, Jay, was that the game against Greece, and I should have been more assiduous about checking whether the exact players from the 2006 Greece team that beat them in the World Championships, that was such a big deal for this team. They're playing Greece in Beijing, and they were so aggressive from the beginning of the game. They never let them get into any perimeter pick and roll. And once again, it was LeBron. It was especially LeBron. And just to go off on him again, doing my research, I was surprised at how few times LeBron has been an all-NBA defensive player. Was I missing something there? You go back to 2013, he was a second-team all-NBA defensive guy. Did I miss something? Isn't he a great defensive player, or does it get recognized, or am I missing something?
He was, and he was at that point, 2013 especially, the peak of his defensive ability in Miami. I think Eric Spoelstra, the Miami Heat coach, used to call him 1 through 5 because you could put LeBron defensively on any position from the point guard to the center. And he was a key part of that team's defense, especially as they started going smaller and didn't have a traditional center. Remember, they had Joel Anthony as a traditional big man at the beginning, and then get away from that, in part because you can get away with that with LeBron's, thanks to LeBron's ability to guard so many people. So you had that then, but then as he goes back to Cleveland, and then especially by the time he gets to L.A. with the Lakers, you could see him taking times. Count the number of times you see him dive on the floor during the regular season, or even his trademark chase down blocks during the regular season. You'd stop seeing that. So it was the right strategy. He's conserving his energy for the playoffs. But as you know, Jack, the way and the time NBA players conserve their energies on defense. So by conserving energy throughout the regular season, LeBron's ranking and his status as a defensive player dwindled. But he can still bring it out when he wants to. He just doesn't choose to do it as much.
Yeah, I guess he was never he wasn't that Kobe Jordan lockdown guy. He wasn't locking down the opposing two guard or switching off on a point guard. He makes a play, by the way, during the Olympics. I think it's, you know, I've lost track. It might have been in the Greece game where he just catches a layup with both hands without goaltending. Now, you know, it didn't come from Kobe Bryant. It came from a smaller player. But LeBron chases it down, jumps up in the air, and catches the ball with two hands. And it wasn't even close to a goaltend. A final moment, though, this is in my top five Olympic moments. Second quarter of the Germany game against Germany. My God, what an atrocious team that was. Dirk Nowitzki couldn't have gotten out of Beijing fast enough. The U.S. beat them 106-57. I mean, they should have used Detlef Schrempf, you know, somewhere. Anyway, in the second quarter, Kobe gets, and by this time, they're gone. You know, this is nothing. We're just fooling around like Bird once in a while used to. I think I'll shoot left-handed the rest of the game. You know what? Let me just shoot some left-handed shots. Kobe gets a no-look pass from Kidd, comes across the lane, and says, what the hell? does like a classic hook shot. I mean, a real, not a jump hook. You know, he wasn't facing the basket. He did that kind of, maybe Joe Jellybean Bryant had done one, you know, 35 years earlier. I don't know. But can you honestly remember, beside Kareem and not counting, you know, a Kevin Garnett jump hook or something like that, can you think of anybody doing a, or the Magic Johnson baby, baby sky hook? Can you think of a hook shot? Somebody did?
I can think literally of one, Jack, and it was in 2000. I'm on the road with the Lakers and they're playing in Milwaukee, and Ray Allen shoots a hook shot in the late. So they're so intimidated. The Milwaukee Bucks are so intimidated by Shaq. This is at his ferocious best. This is Shaq's MVP season. This is when he's fully committed on defense. And the Bucks just wanted no part of him. And Ray Allen, all-time great jump shooter, still right now the career leader in three-point shots made, he goes into the lane. Most guys were just dribbling in and then dribbling out as soon as they saw Shaq. Ray Allen, of all people, goes into the lane and shoots a hook shot. And I'll never forget, Jack, I asked.
Did it go in?
Of course not. Ray Allen doesn't
shoot hook shot. Kobe's went in. I didn't make this point. So, Kobe's went in, by the way. Kobe's hook shot went in.
He could have made more if he had wanted to take more, but he just didn't want to. But Ray Allen takes one and misses it. And after the game, I'm in the Milwaukee locker room, and I said, I go to Sam Cassell, one of my favorite people in the NBA. I said, Sam.
Oh, yeah.
You guys, I mean, Ray Allen's shooting hook shots, and you guys didn't seem to want to take a lot of shots in the paint. What's up with that? Sam goes, shit, they got Shaq in that motherfucker.
Sam Cassell. But beside that, you know, I don't have much else from the games until we get to Spain. We're going to deconstruct that Spain game. And I wondered how, you know, I'm betting Coach K still spent a lot of freaking time there in the film room.
Yeah, Jack. I mean, they win their games by an average score of 106-78. And yet Coach K is still studying game tape like a madman. And let's just say that didn't fit in with Jim Boeheim's idea of how they should be spending their time in Beijing.
Well, I would go out all day. My kids were there. Mike would sleep all day. We would play the game at 9 o'clock, get back at 11:30, eat. 1 o'clock, we'd start watching tape. So now it's 4 in the morning. I've been up since 7. I fell right under the floor. I never did that. Right under the floor. They wanted to get me a seatbelt.
Jim could sleep, though. I can tell you that. There was during the year I was doing a book with him, he had one thing. The first day we were doing it, they were going to play a game or something. I said, well, I'll come over in the morning. We'll do some stuff. No. I said, well, what are you doing? He goes, I just sleep the day of the game. That's what I do. I don't want to see you. Don't come over. That's what I do. But, you know, it's surprising that Boeheim could go anywhere, by the way, given how restrictive things were in Beijing. And the person that had to deal with it the most was Craig Miller, who was USA Basketball's chief communications officer. And he had been in charge of the program, as we said before. He had done that job before the Dream Team. And here he is describing being in Beijing in 2008.
Yeah, I think Beijing, it was really the restrictive government and treatment of the non-mainstream, if you will. Pollution was certainly a concern. But if you remember, Beijing shut down kind of its industrial areas. And the weather actually during the Olympics was beautiful. It was blue skies, you know, and not at all like it what it was when I went for some site reviews and some setup meetings. But I think the primary one in 2008 was really the, you know, the government and its controlling factor. And in fact, that was a case. It's the only Olympics where I was told what rooms we would have media interviews in at the hotel. It was the only, it's really the first, it was the first Olympics where I had to supply 24 hours in advance a list of media that would be coming to do interviews, and they would approve it. So like if USA Today or Sports Illustrated wanted to come and do an interview with D. Wade, I'd have to put him on the list, have it in 24 hours in advance, and the government would review it and approve it. And then they would tell me that I would use meeting room C. And, you know, we always joked that was so they could hear the whole interview firsthand.
You're listening to Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. We'll be back after this.
But I guess the good thing about the government being so restrictive and controlling every aspect of what went on in China and in Beijing during those Olympics was that they were so restrictive, they could even control the smog. They limited the travel and the access. And so the air pollution went down. The same thing happened in L.A. in 84, Jack. I was living in L.A.
Peter Uberoff controlled the weather in 1984.
But what they did was, well, first of all, they scared so many people off that people fled the city. And then they had the companies that worked out that had their offices downtown. They had them stagger their work schedules. So you just didn't have as many cars on the road polluting the atmosphere. And Jack, those were two of the most glorious weeks in the history of Los Angeles. The weather was great. There was no smog and there was no traffic. It was great. Let's go back to 2008. And let's discuss the players that we haven't talked to or talked about over the course of this podcast. Run them down real quick. Carlos Boozer. He was a player that you could find then in 2008 that you wouldn't really see too much in today's NBA. And he was a 6'9" power player, not a stretch four. He made 1 3-pointer in 14 attempts in his career. And you had, it was a transition. So at that time, Jack, you had guys like Rashard Lewis, a 6'9", 6'10" guy who shot a lot of 3-pointers. But that was still more of a novelty than the norm. But he was a power guy.
Yeah, and I loved Carlos Boozer's game, but I do wonder, you know, you got into that I'm a back to the basket guy. He had probably played there from, you know, he played that way in college. And you just wonder if he would have become, you know, something really, really special if he would have got a face up game. But, you know, that's 2020 hindsight, or is, you know, that's what that is. But I always thought maybe he limited himself a little bit, and he was not able to find many minutes on this team.
No, another guy who struggled to get playing time was Tayshaun Prince. Now, he was a defensive force. Arms that just went on forever. And it's funny, how many guys, when you think of their highlight, it's defensive? And I know LeBron had that amazing block in Game 7 to win the championship for Cleveland, but there's still plenty of highlights for LeBron that we think of. Tayshaun Prince, I would say the highlight reel consists of one play, that chase down block that he had against Reggie Miller in the playoffs. He was a 4-time all-defensive second-team member, never averaged 15 points per game, and yet had a long NBA career and found a place onto this team as well.
You know, here he is with LeBron and Kobe, and in our interviews with people, you know, Jay, he always came up. You know, he was, oh man, I remember D'Antoni said it. We're not running the audio, but D'Antoni talked about him. Colangelo talked about him. Mike Krzyzewski talked about him. You know why? He was just fit into that high IQ type of game. He had one great moment in one of the games. He made stepped in the passing lane, you know, made a great one-handed tomahawk dunk. But there, you can't play 12 guys. I mean, 9... I would say, right, Jay? 9's kind of your limit on any kind of team. And that's just the way that it was. And I'm not saying Tayshaun should have got more minutes, but he certainly could have, the way he fit in.
It was good at least to have the Pistons represented in this era. And of course, that is a major glare of the Dream Team in 92, was that Isaiah Thomas and his two championships and the Pistons' two championships weren't represented. So at least Tayshaun helps remind you, when you go back and see this, of what the Pistons meant to that league. And remember, that group was a game away from being 2-time champions. You know, if Rasheed Wallace doesn't commit the unpardonable sin of leaving Robert Horry.
Don't leave Big Shot. I can still hear people screaming, don't leave him.
You can't leave Big Shot Robert Horry alone at a big moment in a playoff game. And that's what he did to go double Manu Ginobili. If not for that, and even despite that, they still took that series to 7 games, came within a game of beating the Spurs, but the Spurs win Game 7 at home in 2005. They would have been back-to-back champions. But even after that, the Miami Heat still had to go through the Pistons to get to the championship in 2006. LeBron James had to go through them to get to the finals in 2007. The Celtics had to go through them in the conference finals to get to their championship in 2008. So let's not forget the Pistons. And through Tayshaun Prince, we can give them a little shout out in the context of this Redeem team. Michael Redd, another player on that team, an outside shooter. It's funny, we think of him as an outside shooter, but he was only in the top 10 of 3-point shooting percentage twice. And the last time was in 2003. So long before this team, but there just weren't that many shooters around, American shooters around in the league at that time. And then sadly, he tore up his left knee in January of 2009. And then he re-tore those same ligaments a year later, and he was basically done. And we really don't think or talk about him that much. But at a time when you needed a guy to shoot, now, Jack, you have everyone is expected to be able to shoot from every position. Nikola Jokic is expected to shoot three-pointers. Your point guards are expected to shoot three-pointers. But at that time, and for that team, you needed a three-point specialist. And the problem for putting together Olympic basketball teams for America is a lot of the best shooters weren't American. Back then, Peja Stojakovic and Hedo Turkoglu, Peja was one of three players who made more than 200 three-pointers that season in 2008. He was one-third of that 200 club. In 2019, which was the last time we had a full NBA season, 12 players made more than 200. And so you just have more shooting available. You have more players who can shoot, more Americans who can shoot three-pointers. But Michael Redd was really a relic from that era, and that's how he wound up on that team.
Yeah, that was a big fear. I remember the Dream Team organization. That was the fear, that it's a 40-minute game. Uh-oh, we start missing. And that's why Chris Mullin, who in many ways, you know, hadn't won, I'm trying to think who I would compare him to on the Redeem team, was an established player, but hadn't won a championship. But as I recall it, Chris Mullin was one of like Chuck Daly first five guys that he wanted.
We need a shooter.
After Jordan, Pippen, and because he was a shooter. And as it turns out, Kobe was such a good, probably didn't need him, but Michael Redd, it just speaks to the time, Jay. There are many metrics about how the game has changed. And I've talked endlessly about the Phoenix Suns, my guys from early in the aughts revolutionizing the league with the number of three-point attempts, and now they would be near the bottom. Michael Redd, known, as you said, as a, an outside shooter with range, I looked this up. He would average about, in his most three-point taking season, he didn't even average six threes a game. He was around five, four and a half. And right now that would put him about in the top 60 of three-point shooters in the NBA. And that's just an example of, how much the game has changed.
So with this 2008 team, though, Kobe says, I'll handle that. Michael Redd, your services aren't needed. Kobe averaged 6.5 three-point attempts per game in only 23 minutes. So he led the Redeem team with 53 three-point attempts, made 17 for the 32% percentage in eight games. Got a 53 three-pointer. So Kobe decided he would take on the three-point shooting duties. So that's our sort of final observations on this team, is our look at their run through pool play and even the medal round as we got into that. And as we'll find out in our next episode, things got a lot tighter after all that cruising and fun that they had and sleeping that Jim Boeheim got in. Things were about to get a lot more serious in the gold medal game against Spain.
Well, there was definitely a lot of pressure. We knew that was not going to be easy. They always seemed to, these teams played their best right in the best moments. The things I remember is that you couldn't shake them. Every time you get up like 5 or 6 points, you think, okay, now you can break it open. They'd hit a big three or hit a couple big threes in a row and back to where it was scary. It stayed scary the whole game.
The only thing that was going through my mind was like, damn, we can't stop these guys. You know what I mean? It was a spirited effort by both teams.
Who would they lean on to save the day? We'll have all that and more in the next episode of Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. For now, I'm Jay Adande.
And I'm Jack McCallum. Thanks for listening. The Dream Team Tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, is a production of Diversion Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This season is written and hosted by me, Jack McCallum, and J.A. Adande. Executive producers Scott Waxman and Mark Francis for Diversion Podcast, and Sean Titone for iHeartRadio. Our editorial director is John Tuttle. Supervising producer Brian Murphy. Legal producer Freddie Overstegen. Editing, mixing, and sound design by Mark Francis. Verna Fields is our technical producer, and our director of marketing and business development is Jacob Bronstein.
Diversion Podcasts.